This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
Social Security's in trouble, right? If it's not going to go bust, something needs to be done. Cut benefits, raise retirement age, increase taxes, or all three. This is not the first time you've heard this. But as for accuracy, maybe not so much. Some time back, a Virginia economist put together a highly detailed analysis of Social Security's future and found, without making any changes, recipients decades from now would be getting significantly more in benefits than they do today. Thing is, these findings only recently began gaining traction among economists across the country. One of them went so far as to name the analysis Rosser's Equation after the original author. So, we've asked Jay Barclay Rosser to talk Social Security, economics, and politics with us right after the news.
Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Economic policy in general, Social Security in particular, will be among our focal points today, and along the way, we are sure to look at how political ideas about economics take hold, even if they are not necessarily based on sound research. As always, if you care to add your voice to the conversation, please do call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. We'll start with an analysis of Social Security that was done some years back, but has recently gotten much more traction with economists around the country, one of whom decided to name this analysis Rosser's Equation after its original Virginia author. And it is a pleasure to welcome that particular author back to the Insight Studio, economist Jay Barclay Rosser. Great to see you again.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
So, Barclay, what is Rosser's Equation?
It's basically just some ratios of expected future benefits from Social Security to what people are receiving now after accounting for inflation. So the equation itself is really trivial. What goes into it that's important and is not trivial are various projections from the Social Security Administration involving birth rates, death rates, immigration, economic growth, productivity growth, wage growth, inflation, and so on. So that's where the heavy lifting comes from, and really, it's just a matter of aggregating those things together and looking at ratios of what people can expect to receive sometime in the future after inflation compared to what people today are receiving after inflation.
And so part of what you did, Barclay Rosser, was to look at figures that the Social Security Administration makes available.
Yes.
All kinds of different projections.
Right.
And then compile them in a way where, based also on what you believe as an economist is likely to be happening in the future, coming up with what you think the Social Security Administration is going to be able to pay out to retirees in the program 20 or 30 years from now.
Right.
What'd you find?
Well, okay. First of all, let me note that the Social Security Administration issues annual reports. So each year there's a new set of numbers. They keep tweaking these numbers and so on. So, you know, these things change gradually over time. Let me report what was sort of the most dramatic thing that I think people are least aware of, and what was what I originally looked at back in 2005. And
this is when you first made this compilation, even though it's only recently begun to get circulated as Rosser's Equation.
Somebody else, a man named Bruce Webb, started calling it Rosser's Equation about 3 years ago, and it's been picked up on the internet and so on, and so it's out there. But the original issue had to do with what happens when the Social Security trust fund goes quote-unquote bankrupt. This is what we hear in the media. We hear that around 2035, the Social Security Administration will go quote-unquote bankrupt.
Well, tell me what that quote-unquote bankrupt means.
What that means is that the accumulated trust fund, now about $2.5 trillion, will be used up. So where did that trust fund come from? It came from the fact that the Social Security Administration, so for the last 30 years, has been taking more in taxes, Social Security taxes, FICA, payroll taxes, than it's been paying out to recipients. It's been lending that money to the rest of the government, which has been giving government bonds that are as good as any government bond that anybody else has to the Social Security Trust Fund. Starting around now, it's kind of in a balance, those bonds will be gradually cashed in to help pay for Social Security recipients.
So the government over the next 20, 22 years is going to be paying back that $2.5 trillion it owes to the Social Security program. And the prediction is that it will have paid all of that back by about 2035.
That's right. So this is the moment where people say, aha, we're bankrupt. So the question arises, what actually happens if we go bankrupt? I don't think that that's going to happen, but let's just say it happens. And I think that there are lots and lots of people, especially younger people, who have heard this terminology, and they think that what happens then is that there are going to be no Social Security payments at all. I mean, a majority of people under the age 30 think that they're not going to get any Social Security. And one of the things that happened in 2005 was I and some colleagues did polls. We found students are just, you know, very, very pessimistic. The young people, they think they're not going to get any Social Security, or they're going to get very, very little. However, what turns out to be the case is that after this so-called bankruptcy, assuming that the main projections are fulfilled, what recipients in the future after this bankruptcy will be receiving after inflation compared to current recipients is on the order of 120%. They'll be getting 20% more than what current recipients are getting.
How is that possible?
Because there will be a gain in what people are getting. There would be a cut, but it would be a cut from around 170% back to 120%.
Okay, let me track these figures. When you say 170%, economist J. Barclay Rosser, what you're referring to is the notion that somebody who is retiring today at age 66 can expect that compared to how much they have paid into the system over their lifetime, in the years that they stay alive and continue being retired and collecting Social Security, they're going to get about 170% of what they paid in.
Well, that's actually a separate question. It turns out the number is about the same. So you and I were talking about this, and that's really another...
Okay, so confuse another, me some more.
Okay, well, that's a question about the total payment in over your lifetime versus the total amount you get. This is a question of, in a single year, a recipient, let's say in 2036, mm-hmm. the year after a so-called bankruptcy. Now, here's the thing people have to remember. The Social Security Administration will still be getting money. It will be getting money from people currently paying Social Security taxes. Unless somebody comes in and undoes the system or abolishes it, the Social Security, and I don't think anybody's going to do that, there will still be people working. They will be paying FICA, Social Security taxes. Money will be coming in. So what in effect would happen is that the system, you know, once these accumulated bonds are gone, it will go back to as being a kind of a pay-as-you-go system. What comes in has to go out, and what people can be paid is exactly what's coming in. Well, that amount will still be enough to pay for those recipients in a given year to get more after inflation than current recipients. Now, if there were no adjustments, there would have been a cut from what they were getting the year before, but that's when they would have been still, you know, the government has still been paying off these old bonds. But even after the bonds are paid off, the current flow of tax revenues is projected to be such that recipients will be doing better in real terms. Now, I can tell you in 2005, not a single one of out of about 250 students knew this. They all thought those future recipients would be getting less, and many of them thought it would be zero. And I think, again, polls show a majority of young people think they'll get zero from Social Security. And that's just completely false. It's in much better shape than most people think.
Why do people have such pessimism?
Well, I think, frankly, a lot of it has been a very, very long media story that has been pushed for nearly 20 years. It's a bipartisan thing. It goes back to the 90s. You had various, frankly, I'll give my frank opinion. I think one of the things that lay behind this was people on Wall Street wanting to get private accounts set up, to have the private sector take over Social Security. And this would be billions and billions of dollars of business for investment bankers in Wall Street. Robert Rubin was the Treasury Secretary for President Clinton, and a lot of people associated with that group became very influential in Washington. They were funding various think tanks. And this was bipartisan. You had both Democrats and Republicans. You had the Democratic-leaning Brookings Institution. You had Heritage Foundation of Republicans, Peterson Institute, which is kind of bipartisan. And many of the people sort of in charge of those outfits they got worried that there was a crisis happening. And there never was. But this became, these people sort of were talking to each other and talking to each other, and it became very entrenched in the Washington Post and the New York Times And the major media, some of us call them the very serious people, have convinced themselves. And
let me see if I'm tracking, Barclay. It's your theory that this got started because people on Wall Street saw that if they could persuade the political class to move Social Security to a private system where everything would be invested in things like the stock market, that then Wall Street bankers and others would be making huge profits.
Oh, yeah.
So in order to make their case, what they started doing was beating a drum saying, if you don't do this, Social Security is going to go bankrupt.
Right.
And that case that they began to make, although you don't feel it was based on any reasonable evidence.
It was misleading back then. It still
But it became sort of a self-fulfilling
it became
message.
Deeply entrenched. And certain language like bankruptcy got used. And people didn't question what this was. What did this mean? Now, I think later what happened was that Social Security got caught up in various discussions about grand bargains, because it is with defense the largest expenditure. It's one of the two largest expenditures of the federal government. So if you're worrying about budget deficits and you have some idea of, well, what we need is some kind of grand bargain to raise taxes and cut spending, there's only five items in the federal budget that are more than $100 billion a year: they're defense, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the national debt. Everything else is small change. And so, you know, when people start talking about, well, we have to have some kind of grand bargain and some bipartisan deal, then they start looking at Social Security and say, well, we need to cut benefits and raise taxes and so on. But if you actually look at Social Security itself, it really is not the source of the problem. It's really not in trouble. But this became a kind of entrenched thing in the political system. I was just talking to one of the people who works here who was talking to a former staff member of recently retired Senator Kent Conrad, who is chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and a kind of moderate. He was one of the people very much involved in these discussions. And I was told that, in fact, Senator Conrad knew full well that Social Security was not in trouble, but said, you can't convince people of that. So if you're going to have a grand bargain kind of negotiation, then people say, oh, we have to put Social Security on the table. We have to do this. We have to do that. But every time you try to do it, people don't. The fact of the matter is that the popular opinion, including among Republicans, is people don't want the benefits cut. And even among Republicans, people are more willing to have a tax increase to maintain benefits. So people really don't want Social Security on the table.
Economist J. Barclay Rosser is our guest. He's the author of an analysis on the future of Social Security that other economists across the country have begun calling Rosser's equation. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you'd like to join this conversation, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or you can type a message, comment, or question on our Facebook page, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And I think, Barclay, I'm going to have just enough time to read Mike's fairly long comment that was posted on Facebook a little while ago, and then after the break, ask you to respond.
Okay.
So here's what Mike says. Quote, I realize that Social Security and Medicare have often been called the third rail of politics, but people can act more than a little crazy over these things. I still remember that scene played out over and over on TV back in the 1980s when a Chicago congressman had his car surrounded by dozens of enraged senior citizens. They were livid that Congress had voted to have them pay a little more for increased benefits. Does the guest have any thoughts on why issues like Social Security invoke such passion and often such profound misunderstanding of the facts? And just in the 15 seconds we've got before we go to the break, Barclay, tell me if you remember the incident that he was talking about.
Yes. Well, I would note that this was associated with the 1983 Greenspan Commission that raised Social Security taxes substantially and put in place increases in the retirement age, which are still rolling in.
And this was the Chicago congressman who chaired the Ways and Means Committee, Dan
Rostenkowski.
Okay. But the whole idea of why people have such passion about these issues, we're going to ask you to follow up on when we continue in just a bit more than 1 minute here on Virginia Insight. To
you who are listening, when do you plan to retire? How much of a role do you expect Social Security to play in your finances when you retire? How confident are you that the federal retirement program will provide the kind of benefits you want it to? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, you can find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Jay Barclay Rosser, Jr., an economist from James Madison University, is our guest. And Mike's question about people's passion and sometimes passionate belief in misinformation when it comes to Social Security and Medicare, we read before the break. Your response.
Okay. Well, during the break, I was reminded that actually that had to do with an increase in premiums for Medicare associated with an increase in catastrophic coverage. So I don't want to really get off into Medicare, but I think the basic issue is very much the same for the two. And indeed, in 1983, we did have a big change in Social Security. And I think a lot of the issue is that for both of them, what you have is, and why it's very hard, especially to, let's say, try to cut benefits, and why people get very, very unhappy when they hear about a proposal to cut future benefits for either Medicare or Social Security, is that people have been paying in Social Security / FICA taxes and Medicare taxes for long periods of time. I mean, those programs have been in, I mean, Social Security goes back to the 30s and Medicare to the 60s, so most people who are working, they've all their working lives, they've been paying these taxes. And there's a sense of, I've been paying in, and now I deserve to collect, and I don't want somebody taking this away from me. I would note, particularly with regard to Social Security, that the FICA or payroll tax or Social Security, this is the largest tax that 3/4 of the American population pays. Much larger proportion than the federal income tax. There's a bit less attention to it than the income tax because it's just taken, unless you're self-employed, it just simply withdraws, it's taken from your paycheck. It's withheld. But for 3/4 of the population, that's the biggest tax they pay, bigger than property tax, state income tax, federal income tax. So it's a lot of money. And most people know it. They're aware they're paying a lot of money. So it's a big deal and it's a huge program. So when people say, who's been working for a long time, they say, I've been paying in. And then somebody comes along and says, hey, we need to cut the benefits. People get very, very angry. They've been paying a lot of money and that's, Medicare is not quite as big, but basically I think the issue is the same. And of course, people who are current recipients and somebody comes in and says, oh, you have to pay more on your premium. People get very upset and say, hey, I've been paying taxes on this for years and years, decades. Why should I have to be hit with this? So,
Economist Barclay Rosser, I just want to double check. So we had mic problem there for a second. Economist Barclay Rosser, Mike's question in part seems to imply his sense that a lot of people have in their head misinformation about programs like Social Security and Medicare. And his memory is better than mine. He's talking about an incident back in the 1980s. But I do recall that it was just 2 or 3 years ago when there were a series of town hall meetings around America with Congress people, and when the Tea Party first began to develop its voice, you would see coverage in newspapers and on television where people were holding up signs saying things like, keep your government hands off my Medicare, or keep the government away from Social Security. Implying that people thought that Social Security and Medicare had nothing to do with government. And that seems to speak to what Mike's saying, is that people seem to get a little crazy about this stuff.
Well, there's a lot of emotional. I really want to not get into Medicare. I will say that Medicare has substantially worse financial problems than Social Security, as does Medicaid. But that gets us off into a whole bunch of other issues. Which I think we really,
but
I'd rather
in,
not.
In terms
but
of I think people in terms getting of, misinformed.
Right.
And
people
passionate.
Are misinformed. And I think, in terms of Medicare, there are a lot of people who somehow think that Medicare is some kind of private program. There's lots of instances. Let me pull back and note that, there's more than one way to view this. And let me kind of just focus again really on Social Security, although the same issue really does apply to Medicare. There's a number of ways of thinking about it, and you can't absolutely say that all of them are absolutely wrong. So here's a really hard-nosed way that probably most Social Security recipients and Medicare recipients both would not be happy about. But there's some truth to this, that it's welfare for the old. Now, what's the basis of that? Well, people who are eligible, they're not paying in anymore, and they're getting paid by other people's taxes, okay, one way or another. So it's welfare for the old. Now, that's, of course, not the way most people think about it. Another way of thinking about it that I would say is also not really quite accurate is, oh, well, it's an investment. Now, this is way a lot of probably, this might be what the majority of people think. It's an investment. In fact, discussions that Tom and I were having off camera sort of had an implication of this. Oh, I'm investing my money with my taxes, and then I'm going to get my return, and we can compare rates of return between this versus that and the other thing and so on and so on. However, if you go back to what it was originally declared to be, and if you go read the literature, it officially is described as, and this goes all the way back to Chancellor Bismarck in Germany in the 1870s or 1880s when the very first Social Security system was set up, which the U.S. system was modeled. The proper way to think about this is it's social insurance, all right? Now, if you stop and think about insurance, private insurance, you don't really actually expect to get a positive return. It's to cover you for something bad happening, right? Insurance companies, private insurance companies, they're making money off of you because they expect you to pay more in premium, and then if you have something bad happen, they cover you, okay? Social insurance is, this is sort of the payment you ought to get if everything else goes bad. You know, people should, of course, be saving and, you know, providing, getting pensions and, you know, various kinds of things and so on. But if, you know, bad things happen to people, they can lose their money because of some kind of, you know, awful thing, even if they're saving it. So this is like, if you have nothing else, you know, you don't have any children, you lose your money in some kind of unfortunate thing, there it is. You've got Social Security. It is insurance. You're completely, you have nothing else, you can count on Social Security. And during this most recent recession, a lot of people became much more aware of that. People had their stock portfolios, and then the stock market went down to half of what it was, and suddenly people were going, oh my heavens, you know, I was counting on this, and their houses also, their houses fell in value. So you know, all these people who sort of thought, oh, you go back to 2007 to 2008, all these people thought they were very wealthy. They had, you know, I have a valuable house, I've got a big stock portfolio. And then all this stuff, you know, fell enormously in value. And suddenly they're sitting there going, oh my heavens, what am I going to do for retirement? And what was the one thing that was there? Oh, Social Security. It's really social insurance.
On Facebook, we have this from Jennifer, who says, when he was running for president years ago, Al Gore used to talk about creating a lockbox for Social Security. That idea never seemed to go anywhere. Would Social Security be in better condition if that lockbox proposal had been taken seriously? And perhaps your guest could explain just what that lockbox would have done. Barclay Rosser?
Well, I guess on this, I'm going to agree with the critics of Gore. I think this was really a kind of a political slogan. I think what he really wanted to say was, I'm not going to touch Social Security. I'm certainly not going to touch the benefits. And I'm, you know, I want to maintain the program. I think that's what he really meant by the lockbox. Because of, at that point in time, Social Security was lending money to the rest of the government. And I think this may have had something to do with the trust fund. But in fact, the trust fund was being used to fund the rest of the government, as we've already described. So I think the broader context of that was that he did not want, it was part of a broader discussion, that he did not want to undo the broader finances of the government. It should be remembered in 2000, the U.S. government as a whole was actually running a surplus at that time. So in fact, the government didn't really need Social Security to be lending it money. Well, actually part of that surplus was the Social Security system lending it money. But the fiscal situation was much better. Basically, Gore wanted to continue the system, and his opponent, George Bush, wanted to cut taxes and did so. And so, in fact, what happened over the next several years was, when after Bush won, was that we went from having an overall budget surplus to having overall budget deficit, which, in effect, you might say, put more pressure on the Social Security system to be providing money for the rest of the government. Of course, we also had some spending increases for various things, But the lockbox itself, I think, was really kind of a metaphor and kind of a political slogan. But I think it was Gore saying, I'm going to preserving the fiscal responsibility of the government, maintain the surplus that we had then, and so on, which, of course, we don't have anymore.
To you on the other side of your radio, might you be at least 20 or 30 years away from retirement yourself, or more? How much thought have you given to the future of Social Security, to what you've been paying into that program? 888-WMRA-TALK is our phone number, 888-967-2825. J. Barclay Rosser, Jr., professor of economics from James Madison University. Getting back to your original point about how Rosser's equation is showing that what most people think about Social Security is absolutely not true, that more than 20 years from now, it's not only going to be fine, but it's going to be able to pay out in real terms more than current recipients are getting. This whole question about why people have such an opposite idea, and you were talking a little bit about the drumbeat that started some 20 years ago from self-interested groups who wanted to see Social Security pushed towards privatization.
Right. Well, let me...
What I'm curious about is there are people that you wouldn't think are connected to Wall Street. There are editorial page writers at the Washington Post who generally are pretty liberal, who are talking about how we have to save Social Security, how we have to raise the retirement age or increase the taxes or cut benefits or something. Why is it that voices on all sides of the political spectrum seem to be celebrating something that you and other economists say is simply not true?
Well, let me first of all note that I think that at the current time, this privatization issue has basically gone away. That's where I think it originally got going back in the 90s. And it was, you know, people who were funding both political parties and think tanks of both political parties that got it going. I think the last time that we had a serious effort to push privatization was, in fact, in 2005. After Bush was reelected, he made an effort to sort of try to partially privatize the system, and that did not go anywhere politically. So the current discussion, nobody's really seriously talking about this privatization, but I think it's one of these things that it got entrenched. A lot of this is sort of conformity. I mean, I've been in rooms in Washington where you have people sitting around, and it's gotten so deeply entrenched over such a long period of time where people have just been repeating this and repeating this and repeating this to each other, that if you say something to the contrary, they kind of look at you like you've lost your mind, even though you're right. But they've said it so many times to each other, and they become personally invested. So someone I'm thinking about, and I think Tom is referring to, is Fred Hyatt, who is the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, and he's one of these people who's just very, very deeply committed to the idea that we must do something about Social Security now, whenever. And he had a column on Monday in the Washington Post under his own name instead of the usual anonymous thing, where he was lamenting the fact that the budget deficit is now going down more rapidly than we thought it would. We've had, if you will, a kind of a, without thinking about it, we've had sort of the equivalent of a grand bargain. We had some tax increases at the beginning of the year. In fact, Social Security tax increases plus some increases on upper income people. These are technically ending tax cuts for those groups. And we've also had the sequester, a spending cut, which we could criticize and has a lot of problems. But in fact, they're spending cuts. So we've had some spending cuts. We've had some tax increases plus the budget deficit's also going down because of the economy improving, which it's doing. So, in fact, we suddenly discovered the budget deficit's going down much more rapidly. And the people who've pushed for the doing something to, that's my view, doing something to or with the Social Security have tried to use the fear of deficits or we've got to have a grand bargain. We must do something about Social. So they're now, these people are now very, very unhappy that the political pressure is receding to doing something about Social Security right now.
They're unhappy that our economy is improving.
That's right. I mean, Hyatt posed a completely bizarre kind of thing. He says, well, we can't raise taxes any further. We can't cut defense spending any further. So if we don't cut Social Security, and we can't do anything with Medicare. So if we don't cut Social Security, what's going to happen is over the next couple of decades, we're going to cut about a third of the rest of the budget. And so all of you people who love, you know, research funding and the Weather Service, and it's going to be your fault that you didn't support cutting future benefits now for Social Security recipients. And it's just, you know, when you stop and say, here's my bottom line. What people are being told is that we must cut future benefits now, because if we don't, we might have to cut future benefits in the future. That's really what's going on. But no, it's a great deal of frustration by the and I mean, I don't know, you know, some I mean, I've never met Fred Hyatt, but I can tell you, you look at the Washington Post editorial page and almost everybody repeats these lines, including several others who are supposedly liberals like Ruth Marcus and Robert J. Samuelson. They push these lines like Hyatt. Very few people on the Washington Post editorial page actually question this. There's very much kind of a conformism here. You don't want to be out of line. People say you're not serious. This is why we have these jokes about very serious people. Oh, I'm very serious. I know that Social Security is in crisis, but it's not.
Barclay Rosser is a professor of economics as well as a named professor in business administration at James Madison University. He has written extensively about the connections between economics and chaos theory, including the book From Catastrophe to Chaos, A General Theory of Economic Discontinuities. But we're discussing primarily now something that he wrote a number of years ago that only fairly recently has begun to get a lot of attention and that other economists have started calling Rosser's equation. It was his analysis of how, if things stay the same over the next 20 years from now, Social Security is not only not going to have problems, but it's going to be able, in real dollars, to pay more in benefits than it pays today. Our phone number, 888-WMRA, talk 888-967-2825. Barclay, you used a phrase there that I think may originally go to the Nobel-winning liberal economist, Paul Krugman, what he calls VSPs, very serious people, that he basically makes fun of.
Yes.
But there is this, what sometimes I think can be thought of as a political class in America that gets a drumbeat going about specific issues, often dealing with economics, where many people fall in line. So I'm curious if you see other areas of where the science of economics and the realities of politics are clashing in today's world.
Well, let me note, we've talked about this before, but I think the fact that there's a great deal of ignorance about the situation of Social Security is broader. Very unfortunately, the general population, large numbers of people, really don't know what the federal budget is. Something like 45% of the American people, this is a poll from several years ago, think that the largest item in the federal budget is either welfare. Now, this is your old welfare for, you know, single family headed households, not Social Security or something like that, or foreign aid. And foreign aid is less than 1%. And traditional welfare is also on that order. They're way, way, way down the list. So you have an enormous amount of misinformation, disinformation, and this just completely distorts political and economic discussions. People can be misled and led around by the nose or whatever into all sorts of silly things.
Well, let's talk more about politics and economics and what you there on the other side of the radio believe when we get back from the break in just a bit more than 1 minute. Economist J. Barclay Rosser is our guest. He's the author of Analysis on the Future of Social Security that other economists across the country have begun calling Rosser's Equation. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And part of what we're discussing involves how people active in politics can influence certain ideas on economic policy. So that gets me wondering about you there on the other side of the radio. Who are you most likely to believe when you hear predictions being made about the future of our economy or even about political developments in general? Is there someone who's gained your trust because their track record with predictions has been so good? Or is it possible we're most likely to believe particular prognosticators simply because what they're saying fits with what we already believe?
The listener insight line is open at 888-WMRA-TALK. You want to talk about what's going on, Barclay, in other countries?
If there's not an immediate question or something else coming out. This also fits with the sort of another part of how people have been scared unnecessarily. When you hear the prognostications of the forecasts of doom and bankruptcy and how it won't be there and how there are going to be all these terrible burdens and so forth, one of the things that's often talked about is changes in population. So a well-known statistic, which is certainly basically correct, is that right now there are about 3 workers to every retired person. Of course, current workers are the ones who are paying in for the retired people to get their benefits. And with the baby boomer retirement, which is basically going to be done by about 2030, we're going to have a change in that ratio. Lots of baby boomers are going to retire, and there's not as many people coming up behind. And so that ratio is going to change. It's going to change to be about 2-1. And of course, if you go much farther back to the origins of the system, this ratio was far, far, far higher. So you will often hear people saying, oh, look, you know, in 1938, it was 165-1, and now it's 3-1. Oh, my God, it's going to 2-1. Well, of course, first of all, after about 2030, it's probably going to stabilize at that. But the other thing that a lot of people don't quite realize is that compared to other high-income countries, we are in one of the best conditions of any of them with regard to this basic demographic story. That 2-1 ratio is already what one sees in countries like Germany, for example. Germany is not having any problems. In fact, their pensions are more generous than ours. They're having no problems paying their equivalent of Social Security. They are already at this 2-1 ratio. We have one of the higher rates of growth of population. We have a higher birth rate. We also have a higher immigration rate. This does kind of link up with the immigration issue. If somebody's worried about Social Security financing, they should not be trying to block immigration because you bring younger people. You know. So we are in actually much, much better shape. Of the higher income countries, we're in one of the ones that's in absolutely the best shape in terms of the longer term demography and fundamentals underlying the whole situation. But you don't get told that by the people who are scaring you with these numbers. So,
Jay Barclay Rosser, Jr., economist from James Madison University, our guest. Our number to call in here on Virginia Insight, easy to remember, is 888-WMRA-TALK. Let's go next to Harrisonburg. Joe, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
You asked whom do we trust in terms of making predictions on the economic direction of the U.S.?
I did.
Yes.
No, I did ask that question. I remember. You have an answer.
Yeah, Mish Shedlock, M-I-S-H space S-H-E-D-L-O-C-K, Mish Shedlock. And he's an economist, too, and a financial advisor. And he does a very good job at looking at analysis, economic analysis, and fundamentals such as the yield curves, the unemployment, different unemployment numbers, and interpreting them, showing, for example, that the unemployment numbers which you see produced can't be added together in the way you might think to guess what the actual unemployment rate is. And he's been predicting for some time, of course, the collapse of the Eurozone. And, for example, he mentioned that he said, no hiding places. I've been wondering for well over a year when the day would come that there are no hiding places. Today is one such day. U.S. equities down, Asia equities down, European equities down, and so on. He's been predicting this for some time. And he doesn't always predict collapses, but when he does predict them, he backs them up, and they do come in the way he says. Sometimes they take a little longer, but they do come.
Well, first of all, thanks for the question. I will confess that I don't know anything about Mish Shedlock. Let me just make a couple of comments in terms of what you've just said. I don't know what he has to say about Social Security, but in terms of the collapse of the Eurozone, I'm actually less pessimistic about it. There are very bad problems in the Eurozone. Much of the Eurozone is in actual recession. Output is falling, and it's a terrible strain, terrible political problem. And we may yet see some countries leave. Portugal or Greece may yet leave. But I spend a lot of time in Europe, and There's a different view there. It's mostly Americans who are more vigorous, and that cuts across the political spectrum. Krugman, for example, has been never liked the Eurozone is forecasting its collapse, and a number of more conservative economists like Martin Feldstein also have argued this. But I'm impressed by their ability to kind of muddle through. So I wouldn't say they're necessarily going to collapse, but they've got very bad problems. With regard to the immediate situation, what's going on right now is that the Federal Reserve is backing off finally of their more expansionary monetary policy. Everybody knew that at some point they were going to have to start doing that, and the markets don't like that. So I think for the near term, yeah, we're probably going to see stock markets go down. How far down? I'm not going to forecast that, but I think that one of the reasons why they're willing to back off is if you look at the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, at least, we're doing pretty well. There are some negatives. In fact, I think the sequester is not helping and those tax increases. I mean, but the fundamental that's really, I think, drove their willingness to make this move is housing. And we just had a report today. Housing sales are up more than expected. Housing prices are going up. Housing construction is rising. It was the housing sector that brought us down. By the way, I will slightly brag. I'm one of the people who's been identified as people who called what happened back in 2008, 2009. And that had to do very much with the housing sector and the financial derivatives and so forth associated with that sector. That was what brought us down into the recession. It took years and years to hit bottom, but it has hit bottom and it's coming back. And I think, you know, we could easily have a year where, you know, stock market could go down quite a bit. But I think that the Fed is looking out several years and they're looking as there's a huge pent-up demand for housing. Housing is going to, and housing can drag the whole rest of the economy up. People are building houses. There's been a huge pent-up demand. Then people buy lots of other stuff. They buy furniture. They have to buy, you know, things to put in the houses and so on. So I think there's reason to be optimistic about the longer term of the economy and also the markets, although I think in the near term there's a good chance we probably will see some, you know, bear market for a while.
Joe, thanks so much for sharing your perspective with us here on Virginia Insight. Here on Facebook, economist Barclay Rosser, we have this post from Elizabeth who says, "My dad is having trouble making it on Social Security alone. His Social Security payment goes up by pennies each year, but his Medicare payment goes up a lot more." So I think she's talking about Social Security benefits, what she receives versus what he has to pay in Medicare, perhaps. Each year he ends up with less than the year before. He's not alone.
Well, let me just, I really don't want to talk too much about Medicare, and I think this is probably more the problem here. But I will say that the fundamental problem with Medicare and also Medicaid is that the healthcare system, costs of medical care have been for a very long time rising much more rapidly than the rest of the economy. The inflation rate, than the reinflation rate. And so,
I've heard you use a term in the past, Barclay, that I found fascinating, what I think you called old people's inflation or elderly inflation.
Yeah, well, I'll get to that in a minute. I'm going to talk about the Medicare, and then I'm going to come back and talk about this with regard to Social Security. So we need to get the raw increase in cost of medical care system under control. The actual rate of increase is declining. There is some hope that situation is going to improve, but it's still true that medical care costs are rising at about twice the regular rate of inflation. It's getting better, but it's still bad, and that's going to be an ongoing problem. So I have complete sympathy. Now, with regard to Social Security itself, there is a very serious current issue. President Obama, I think, in an effort to make some nod toward an effort to have a grand bargain, actually proposed changing the cost of living adjustment, the COLA, from the regular consumer price index as it's been measured to a so-called chained index. Now, the chained index, which would lower the rate of increase of benefits in the future. Now, nobody in Congress of either party liked that. It was basically just shot down. Here is the issue on that. The chained index actually is a more accurate way of measuring price increases for the basket of goods you're looking at. So there was actually an argument for that, but it's not a good argument for Social Security. And the fact is that for the elderly buy a different basket of goods. And there is, in fact, a separate measure that is being kept track of, a separate price index for the elderly. And that goes up more rapidly than the regular rate. And the main reason, in fact, is medical care costs. Elderly spend much more money on medical care, even with Medicare there. Those who know about Medicare know elderly have to pay much beyond that. So the elderly are paying a lot more for they're spending a lot more of their money on medical care than the rest of the population.
So if Social Security payouts were based on what you see as this more realistic rate of inflation for the elderly, they would be getting much higher cost of living increases.
The ideal outcome would be to have a chained elderly index, which would probably raise, in fact, the rate a little bit. If we could get the increase in medical care costs down to the rate of the rest of the economy, then this difference between the elderly and the rest of the population would disappear, and this issue would be less serious. So there is an argument for having a chained index, but you should have a chained index that's focused on what the elderly pay for. And I think this addresses exactly the problem that your father's facing. He's facing these higher medical care costs, and Social Security is not going up at a rate to cover that. That's exactly what's going on.
We also have this on Facebook, Barclay Rosser, from Mary Elizabeth, that kind of harks back to what we talked about at the beginning of the hour. She says, about Social Security, word is that the problems started with transfer of Social Security funds to other accounts and costs. How does that work?
Well, we have somewhat talked about this. I'm not sure that it's really a problem, but this is when the system is running a surplus, when tax receipts are coming in greater than the money going out, that surplus gets lent to the rest of the government. And as we've noted, the Social Security Trust Fund then accumulates these bonds that the rest of the government gives them to borrow the money. I think something that might be worth talking about, and it was just briefly mentioned, that gets back to this, is a really big change that happened was in fact 30 years ago in 1983. And I think this is, people should probably be aware of this. It may have forgotten or may never have known. At that time, just before that, in fact, Social Security was not collecting enough money to make benefits. It was just, it wasn't doing very well. And people, we knew what was going to happen. We knew the demography. We knew that we had this huge pile of baby boomers who several decades down the road were going to be retiring, and that we were already far enough along to see that that was being followed by a baby bust. So there were not going to be as many people. So we were going to get these changes in the ratios from 3-1 to 2-1 and so on. And so the concern arose that we have to pay for the baby boomers. What happened was that there was a bipartisan commission chaired by Alan Greenspan, who was later, he was not then, but he was later the longtime chair of the Federal Reserve. This was a bipartisan commission, and it was ultimately signed off by two politicians of Irish ancestry, Republican President Ronald Reagan and Democratic Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill of Massachusetts. And what was involved was, in fact, a substantial increase in the Social Security tax, the FICA, the payroll tax, as well as this move to roll in gradual increases in the retirement age, which the last round of that, in fact, still hasn't come in. Basically, the cutoff is 1954-55. If you're born in 54, you can get fully vested at 66. If you're born later, it's going to be 67. Now, some of the very serious people want to have more of that. Let's push the retirement ages up even further, and also with Medicare as well.
For anybody who's just joined us, you're talking about the VSBs that you and other economists make
very serious people.
Yeah.
So there was a really big change then. And after the Greenspan Commission, then, of course, suddenly we had this big increase in the tax rate. So people who were working then, they were paying much more in Social Security taxes, and that was way more than what was being paid out. And that's when and it was also a period when the government as a whole was running big budget deficits in the 1980s. In any case, at that point in time, the Social Security Administration began lending large amounts of money to the rest of the government, and there were big deficits. And that's when this $2.5 trillion trust fund began to accumulate. It was basically zero at that point. So over the last 30 years, we accumulated this $2.5 trillion, and the argument was that was the baby
and
boomers.
And again, just to make sure I understand, the $2.5 trillion is the amount that the Social Security Administration lent out to the government that the government now owes the rest of the government owes Social Security.
That's right.
And is going to be paying back over the next 22 years.
Okay. Yeah. Or in the terminology of Mary Elizabeth's question, it was the transfer of funds. But the transfer of funds involved this, there was an exchange. Funds were transferred, but what was put back in were these
government bonds. Essence, what you're saying is if somebody owes me $2.5 trillion that they're going to pay back over the next 20 years, and that somebody is good for the money, then I shouldn't worry.
Yeah, I mean, nobody should worry about that any more than we should worry than the Chinese should worry that we're not going to pay their bonds, or that if you've got some government bonds, you're not going to be. Let me note, by the way, how much the world trusts U.S. government debt, in spite of some fights over debt ceilings and so on. When we had the really big financial crisis.
You got 20 seconds left.
In September of 2008, when we had the worst financial crisis, what happened was the dollar went up. Everybody in the entire world was buying U.S. government securities because we were the safe haven. We were the most safest and most reliable place in the entire world.
Our guest has been J. Barclay Rosser, professor of economics and the Kirby L. Kramer professor of business administration at James Madison University. Barclay, as always, it's fascinating spending time with you. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Dr. Rosser is doing. Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.